Welcome to our podcast series, Museums in Motion. My name is Richard Bussmann. I am an Egyptologist at the University of Cologne. And I'm pleased to welcome to the interview today, Monica Hanna. Monica is an Egyptologist and archaeologist at the Arab Academy of Science, Technology and Maritime Transport, where she is also acting as the founding dean of the College of Archaeology and Heritage. Hello, Monica.
Hello, Richard. Thank you very much for inviting me to this discussion. I hope to be in person in Cologne soon, just like the old days.
You're very welcome to come here to Cologne. Monica, would you like to say a few words about yourself, your research interest, and your interest in heritage?
Okay. Well, I'm an Egyptologist by preparation. I have a BA in Egyptology from the American University in Cairo. And then I went on and got a doctorate in archaeology. So I have been trained to be an Egyptologist. But then throughout my training, I was very lucky to be a student for Professor Faiza Haykal, who is very interested in heritage and the heritage discourse and the heritage consumption at the American University in Cairo. And through her, I have explored the other side of Egyptology and came to critique the own discipline from which I have graduated and grew this understanding of such inequalities that are in the discipline and how we can actually start a discourse to understand these inequalities and get to balance these different, to balance out these different inequalities that we have all inherited from 200 years of Egyptology.
Who are these local communities in Egypt, and what do you think is their view on archaeology and heritage? It might be something very different from what heritage experts believe.
Well, I think Egypt is a melting pot, you know, full of different cultural groups. We have the Bedouins, we have the Ababdas, the Bisharis, the Nubians, the Nile Valley dwellers. We have the Arabs, like they call them the Arab, and they also are formed from different tribes. We have the Berbers. We have the different communities that came and lived in Egypt, like the Armenians, like the Turks, the Italians, and the Greeks. So Egypt is formed from all these people. And just as much as ancient Egypt was concerned, ethnicity or color was not an issue. You were either an Egyptian or you were not. So I think this is pretty much the situation up until today. So many people who are perhaps not from different ethnic groups that were inherently in Egypt have become Egyptians and have appropriated the cultural heritage of Egypt to be their own identity. Of course, this is different very much from how the state uses heritage for nationalist discourse. But even this is very different. And I think that a lot of the critique for the nationalist ideas of heritage comes out it stems out from the discourse of repatriation. As soon as you discuss repatriation, they will tell you, you're being nationalist. So I think this is also a critique for nationalism, but there is not really a nationalist view on heritage in Egypt that's unified, because you can see that, for example, the Bedouins of Sinai probably feel a very strong ownership to the temple of Serabit al-Khedem, and these tribes probably immigrated from Yemen centuries ago, and they had no relationship with the ancient Egyptians who built the temple of Hathor. But they feel a very strong feeling about it, because they've lived there, they've worked there. It's part of their environment, and it's also part of their livelihood. Mm-hmm. And during the 2011 revolution, there was no police in the area, and they protected the site. Nothing was stolen. Everything was well kept. And it shows that they would not have protected it if they had not felt such a strong ownership to the site, that it is part of their own heritage. So again, it's not an ethnic question. And when you come to think of indigenous communities in Egypt, they're quite a lot. And if we speak here about the Nubians themselves are also formed of different groups. You have the Arabic Nubians, the Nubians who come from, yani they're even among themselves, they're formed of many groups. And of course, they are a very characteristic group with their own heritage. They probably keep the heritage very dear to them because it is part of their identity and part of what makes them different, especially after the relocation. Perhaps if the relocation of the Nubians would not have happened, perhaps their ideas and views of their heritage would have been different today.
Mm-hmm. I'd be interested in your thoughts on the museums that are currently being set up in the Egyptian provinces. And I would also be interested in how you see these museums positioned in the wider infrastructure of archaeology, museum, and heritage.
I think that many of these local museums are copies from each other. It's always looking at Egypt at this differentiated segment, where ancient Egypt, so then Islamic, and then Coptic. And you see it repeats. It repeats in Sohag, it repeats in Kafr Sheikh, it repeats in Hurghada, it repeats in Sharm el-Sheikh. And I think it has to be different because it's very rare in Egypt that you find a city museum except for the city of Alexandria. And I think the idea of museums is in a crisis at the moment. All museums around the world, not just in Egypt. Because again, as Michel Foucault at one part says, that it's the display of a culture in another culture, or of one culture in another culture. And I think there has been almost zero discourse within the different indigenous communities on how they want their heritage to be displayed, except for the Nubian Museum. I think the Nubian Museum had such discussions with the Nubian communities of how they wanted to be represented. But of course, they were not involved in actually writing the museum narrative itself and the museum display. They still go visit the museum. Speaking about community involvement 10 years ago in Egypt was like speaking about people landing in Jupiter. But today, really, people are actually more receptive to the idea, and such engagement are actually is being taken in concern, especially engaging children and so on. Especially after the attacks that happened in 2013 on the Malawi Museum, they realized that the wall will not protect the archaeological site, the wall will not protect the museum. It's getting the people really involved in the museum and hearing their voices is what will protect this heritage.
I would be just curious if you could say a bit more about, if you know, about this question of community involvement in the Nubian Museum. So what makes a difference? What is actually a difference? So this would be one question, and the second one will come afterwards.
Okay, well, I know that in the Nubian Museum, almost 80% of the visitors are the Nubian communities. They come, they visit, and there are also two centers. One is for the crafts and the arts and crafts, and one is for the intangible heritage of the Nubian.
Mm. And can you say something about the intangible heritage that is on display or thematized?
There is a special display for the intangible heritage in terms of dress, in terms of weddings, in terms of songs and so on. There is a display of intangible heritage, and there is a center for intangible heritage at the museum where like songs and traditions and stuff are being recorded by people at the museum.
So there is a kind of a local archive emerging where people can bring their own.
Yes. And there are also many NGOs working on the same topic, such as Kunuz Nubia. The Nubians themselves are also very keen on this. So without even the involvement of the museum, and sometimes with the involvement of the museum, this happens.
And so my second question would be perhaps to connect this a little bit to the question of these iconic objects that are stored in Europe mm-hmm. and that are claimed by Egypt, for example. So, I mean, is there a discussion or a discourse about how to ensure that there evolve new forms of cooperation and, so to speak, community involvement on a larger scale? So how can you actually forge connections between, let's say, all these Germans who have this kind of nostalgic longing for Nofretiti and then the Egyptians who have it on their, you know, in a very different and, of course, legitimate way? So, I mean, how can one think of developing new forms of cooperation and
I think with the current world inequalities, if you think of a man from Malawi, which is the hometown of Nefertiti, wanting to get a visa and come to Berlin to see the bust of Nefertiti, it's almost impossible that he would get a visa if he doesn't have like huge amounts of money in his bank account or he has a specific job and so on. So, but any German tourist who would like to come to Minya to see Nefertiti, you just get his visa at the airport. So you have also to think of other human rights of traveling and economic situation. So I think this is very clear. I mean, when you come and think about accessibility, I think Nefertiti would be more accessible by being in Egypt rather than in Berlin because more people would actually, non-Schengen visitors would be able to get access to her much easier. And I think Germans, I think it's the third country who sends tourists in Egypt. I think they can come and visit her and see her in her cultural context at any time. It would never be a problem. And I think, again, it's a question of an ethical perspective. Do we want to keep a stolen object, even if it's part of the identity of Berlin now? Or do we actually have changed or have risen above the previous ethical holdings and now we want to become more ethical and actually restitute such an important bust that's also important for women in modern Egypt, as much as it's important for people in Berlin, because she's a symbol of power. I mean, when we speak about empowering women and giving women the voice and the chance, I think Nefertiti is a great example for that. And that's why she should come back.
I saw on your CV that 10 years ago you worked at Humboldt University in Berlin and you also taught a course on Egyptian heritage. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering how your experience with the German curriculum was.
I mean, it was an elective course that I created with my research associate, Dr. Gemma Tully. And I think the German students were really very engaged. They wanted to know, they wanted to understand. There was a different... at that point also, it was the peak of the Egyptian revolution. And it was, you know, this state of fluidity where all different ideas and different coming out from the old and trying to receive the new was going on. And this helped a lot many of the discussions about the democratization of heritage and community engagement and community involvement and cultural rights and human rights. And I think I really enjoyed the discussions with all the students when I taught in Humboldt.
I have a question about restitution. So, I mean, Egypt has claimed repatriation for a long time, but I was wondering if the Savoie report somehow invigorated it, or if it was maybe also controversially discussed because it seems like Egypt is not really part of it. So maybe they did this also because they were afraid they could not implement it if Egypt is also part of it, because Egyptian heritage is so, important. Yeah.
I think it has to do with this idea that Egypt belongs to the ancient Near East rather than Africa. And I think they did not really include Egypt in it because of the mindset of thinking that Egypt is different. Egypt is not Africa. Mm. So again, it's part of the whitewashing of Egypt.
Mm. Okay.
And I think it doesn't change the discourse. That's why I try to work with my colleague, Professor Siraj Rasool, on actually thinking about this and using an African voice and that this is African heritage. Mm-hmm. Because it's also, I mean, if you think also of North Africa, it's different, but Libya has important cultural heritage that needs repatriation, Tunisia, Morocco, and so on. And all this is a little bit left out of the discourse. Mm-hmm. It's more thinking about the Benin bronze that moves the discourse for the rest of the countries.
Mm-hmm. I also was wondering, because within Africa, it has been discussed that things should not go back to museums and should not be happening in between states only, but that things should also be given back to communities.
The objects that would be used in mosques or churches could be given back, but how would you give in a censer for a temple, for example, to the that belonged to Philae temple? We no longer have priestesses of Isis who would be using it. So yeah. I think it's a little bit further, but I think I was in an interesting panel in the Goethe Institute 2 years ago, and we were discussing also ethnographic objects. What if we repatriate ethnographic objects? And part of the ceremony for the object is actually burning it or destroying it. We would actually lose the artifact for good. How should we feel about it? And I personally think that once an object is fully studied and fully published, and maybe a 3D copy is made out of it, if it's part of the living heritage, I think the living heritage should be more precious and more revered, that this object should go back to the community after the study of the object and the proper recording for it.
How would you envision, Monica, a future for archaeology in Egypt and also in conjunction with what is going on in the heritage sector and the museum sector? So now we have this combined ministry of antiquities and tourism, for instance, which introduces a different mindset also to what archaeology might be or what the purpose might be. So how would you say an ideal future looks like?
I think this idea of putting antiquities with tourism is a conflict of interest, because at many times if the tourism would actually tear and wear and would destroy the antiquity. I think they should be separate entities. And again, having a ministry of antiquities, again, a very colonialist perspective. I think we need a ministry of heritage. As they call it in Italian, beni culturali, or patrimoine in France. I think this is what we need at the moment, to have a ministry of heritage, because the heritage, the different types of heritage in Egypt are dispersed along the different bodies. So we have the architectural heritage in the Ministry of Culture under something called the Urban Harmony. We have the antiquities. We have the intangible heritage of the Ministry of Culture, the natural heritage under the Ministry of Environment. So I think this is dividing the heritage among these boards leads to the loss of this heritage and the lack of a proper management and strategy policy. So if tomorrow I'm officially asked of if I would set a strategy for Egypt for the next 20 years, it would be to create a ministry of heritage where these would be different boards working under this ministry away from tourism, because I think the tourism is a separate entity outside of the heritage.
I would like to sort of try to complicate this notion of heritage further, perhaps. So, I mean, in a way, you have emphasized the positive aspect of it, right? So it is important for community identity formations. It's important for communities of practice that form around certain sites, in your example of the Bedouins in Sinai, for example. On the other hand, heritage is, of course, also what Rosalind Morris once called a totalizing discourse, a discourse that sort of gives objects and practices a certain meaning of a universal importance and creates also distance, ruptures, different forms of hierarchies, again, on the ground, on site, between those who administer heritage and those who actually practice you know, like dances or who have some kind of, as you explained, for Nubian heritage, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, so where do you see, or have you experienced certain kinds of controversies around that actually in your work?
I think it has to do, I have not experienced that firsthand, except when I worked in an official Western archaeological mission. In my missions, I really didn't have this problem because they felt that you're Egyptians, we do things collaboratively, what do you want, we talk to the community, there is no barrier. I think such conflict happens when there is a linguistic barrier. If you look at how many Egyptian missions working in Egypt and how many of them know actually Arabic to fully communicate and to fully be able to bring the Egyptians on a collaborative approach where we would stand on the same foot and do the excavation collaboratively equally, you'll find there are very few. So I think it is really a language barrier. It is a communication barrier between the missions working and the communities. But if you look at people who, for example, there has been the Freie University mission in Schott, they have hired a special team for communication that are made of Egyptians. So such friction and such contestation would not happen, that everything would be done together, and that the power relations would not be that severe, that everything could be negotiated, that people would, what they say would actually seriously be heard and not just for cosmetic purposes. So I think it is a communication issue.
Mm. Thank you.
I would really like to know more about that project you're having there with Siraj Rasool, but also maybe how you see the way that sub-Saharan Africa is being treated, you know, in these debates, in these Euro-sub-Saharan African debates versus the Euro-Egyptian debates.
Okay. I think this is actually a very big question. Well, I think that the debates are similar and different because there is a lot of violence in the sub-Saharan restitution. And maybe we Egyptians did not experience such violence in taking away our objects. But many of these sub-Saharan cultures have experienced war, they have experienced cleansing, they have experienced real violence as part of taking away these objects. And so part of the restitution is also the how can we actually restitute in what the violence that has been done and how we can actually become even with the violence that has been done. What I would call closer to in the Egyptian scenario would be also the restitution of the knowledge, because we have not only been stripped of the objects, we have also been stripped of the knowledge. Because as a student, when I really wanted to study archaeology, I went to Italy. I did not go to an Egyptian university because of the archives, because of the museums, and because of the knowledge. So it's the same thing. We need also the restitution of the knowledge and of the knowledge making in Egypt as part of the restitution of the objects.